you're at home right now, look around you. There's a very good chance that the majority of the stuff in your house, from your fridge to the contents of your fridge to your phone and the clothes you're wearing, all arrived from far away in the same way, by sea. So prepare yourself for some eye-watering numbers over the next hour as we try to get to grips with the sheer scale of an industry that feeds the lifestyles we have become accustomed to, the shipping industry. Like, the biggest ships in the world are among the largest moving structures ever made by man and can carry over 24,000 20-foot container units. You can fit 4 football pitches on these ships, and the stacks of containers can reach some 22 stories high. And container ships carry about 90% of goods traded around the world. And yep, that means everything from bananas to baseball caps to beds. But despite the fact that they sustain our everyday lives, the shipping container, as we know it, has been around for little more than 50 years. Today, on the forum from the BBC World Service, we're exploring the story behind the simple metal box that kick-started the modern age of consumerism and turbocharged the growth in world trade. Without it, our economy, indeed our whole way of life, would collapse. I'm Rajan Datta, and I'm joined by two guests. Mark Levinson is an American historian and economist. He's the author of The Box: How the Shipping Container Made the World Smaller and the World Economy Bigger. Now, Mark, seeing as we're starting with mind-blowing figures, tell me, what's your favourite stat about shipping containers?
My favourite stat is 900.
Right.
900% is the amount which international trade in goods has increased since the shipping container came along in a big way in the late 1980s and led to the development of global supply chains. So we have had this enormous, enormous increase in international trade, and this 900% figure really is rather mind-boggling.
It is certainly that, isn't it? And Alan McKinnon is also joining me. He's professor at Kuhne Logistics University in Hamburg in Germany, and he's the author of Decarbonizing Logistics: Distributing Goods in a Low Carbon World. Okay, Alan, the challenge is on. Can you go even bigger than that? What's your favourite number when it comes to understanding the scale of this industry?
My favourite number relates to the amount of truck traffic it would take to move all the containers arriving in the world's current largest vessel, which you mentioned carries more than 24,000 containers. So let's imagine that vessel arrived in Rotterdam, and all of those containers were offloaded and put onto trucks. And let's imagine that there's a convoy of trucks, nose to tail, that convoy would extend from Rotterdam to Cologne. Or if you imagine that there was a gap between the trucks of, say, 25 metres, that convoy would extend to Basel in Switzerland. So it gives you a sense of the vast carrying capacity of these container ships.
It really is pretty impressive, isn't it? Mark, now, forgive the pun, but let's unpack this a little. Let's look a little bit closer at this box. What does a standard shipping container look like?
A standard shipping container is 40 feet long, typically 8 or 8.5 feet high, with doors at one end and a wooden floor. A key part of this equipment is the metal fittings that are at the corners of each container, which has a hole shaped a certain way, and that is really essential so that these containers can be lifted by cranes or they can be locked to one another when they're stacked on board a ship. So all in all, the container by itself isn't a very fancy piece of equipment. One can make it a little bit fancier by adding a refrigeration unit or other kinds of measuring equipment, but a container is a container.
So, Alan, can you then tell us a bit more about the logistics of how these boxes are actually moved around?
There is standardization across landward logistics and maritime logistics. There are a number of standard trade lanes which carry most of the world's container traffic, both laterally across the world and also north to south. They also serve Africa and Latin America. So it is a truly global network. But one other point may be worth making at this stage is that unfortunately trade flows are unbalanced on many of these trade routes. For example, there's an awful lot more full containers go from China to the US than go in the opposite direction. So one of the big challenges that the container shipping lines have is to try to maximise the utilisation of their containers, despite the fact that we have these very pronounced international trade imbalances.
Okay, well, now we mentioned standardisation a couple of times already, and it seems like a very simple concept, and it surprises me in a way that it hasn't been around for longer. So tell me, when and how were standard sizes for shipping containers agreed? I mean, Mark, I can imagine it was a bit like the Wild West before that happened.
The first modern container voyage occurred in the United States in 1956. This was a converted oil tanker that had a deck put on the top of it to handle containers, and that vessel carried 58 containers. So that gives you some idea of what's changed in the scale of shipping since then. Different ship lines then started to carry containers, and each of them picked the container size that it thought was best for its business. There were 17-foot-long containers. There were 24-foot-long containers. And this caused some consternation, particularly for the U.S. military. At that time, we're talking now in the 1950s, a lot of the ship construction in the United States was subsidized by the U.S. government on the condition that in the event of war, the government had the right to commandeer these ships and use them to carry military cargo. And so the Military Sealift Command was asking, what do we do if there's a war and we've got a bunch of ships, some of which carry 24-foot containers and some of which carry 33-foot containers and some of which carry 17-foot containers? How do we actually handle logistics with a mess like that? And so basically the U.S. government told the ship lines and the railroads and the container manufacturers, there needs to be a standard. You guys figure it out. If you don't figure out a standard, we'll figure out a standard for you. So there were years of negotiations. These started off domestically in the United States, and then by the early 60s, they were taken over by the International Organization for Standardization. They were talking about the nitty-gritty of how a container is made. I really consider the engineers who were involved in these negotiations as the heroes of the container story in a certain way. If you can imagine spending 10 years sitting around in smoke-filled rooms talking about how thick the end walls of containers should be, that's what went on here. But think of why you had to have this conversation. To take the example of end walls, if you put a container on a railroad freight car, the train breaks, the container shifts forward, and everything in it shifts forward. So you need a thick end wall. If you put a container on a ship, that doesn't happen. So do you require the end walls be thick, which then raises the cost of making a container? Or do you require that end walls be thinner, which reduces the cost but might cause a problem on a train? That's the sort of discussion that went on for years and years. And it was not just end walls. Where do you put the supports inside the containers so you can stack them atop one another? How many supports do you need? How do the doors open? What should the fittings at the corners look like so the container can be lifted? All of these things had to be standardized. And it really took about 10 years of negotiations internationally before there was an agreement on container standards.
And would you say, Mark, that there was a watershed moment, like a person or incident that really kick-started this?
The key moment in the process probably was when the man whose company first started modern container shipping, Malcolm McLean, agreed that everyone could use the corner fitting that his company had developed and not pay a patent royalty for that. And that is really what made it possible to put a container on a ship and be confident that it could be offloaded at any port in the world. To put a container on a train and know that there would be no trouble moving it from a train to a ship. it was that kind of standardization that was really key in the development of modern container shipping.
Alan?
There are some numbers reflecting the economic and operational benefits of containerization. So it's often said that the speed of the port handling operation increased by about 85% when we moved from sort of manual loading to containerized systems, and also the cost of doing it reduced by about a third. So this was transformational. In the logistics world, people have been looking since then for an innovation which has been of similar magnitude to that of containerization, you know, because it was absolutely transformational to the way in which we moved freight. Sadly, we haven't come across such an innovation, but we desperately wait for something.
I mean, maybe you could argue that the internet was the next big thing that changed the world in a similar way. I mean, you could argue that, couldn't you?
Yes. We could, but in terms of the physical handling of the products and movement of the products, I think it's very doubtful we're ever going to experiencing something that has been so radically different from what was done before.
Well, we managed to speak to somebody with recent experience of working on container ships who can tell us the reality of life on board. Captain Yash Gupta is from India and has been in this industry for 20 years. We asked him about the changes he's seen in that time.
I have been sailing on a merchant vessel for almost 20 years. I started off as a cadet, so initial few years are gone in the training. After a couple of years, we have to give the exams of Ministry of Shipping, and slowly we step up the ladder as an officer, junior officer, and then finally it becomes a captain. So yes, initial days were very homesick, seasick, everything happens to a young boy. I was 18 years when I joined. First time when I joined the ship, it was in Quebec, Canada. The first day of my sailing, it was the St. Lawrence River. So the river is usually very calm. After 7-8 hours of the river passage, the moment we entered the North Atlantic Ocean, and the weather was very, very bad. It was a big container ship, about 5,000 containers, carrying 5,000 containers. But the weather was so bad, and I had a few meals and I vomit, and all those thoughts were coming in my mind that how am I going to be here and for so long. And in the midst of all these thoughts, I slept. And the next day morning when I wake up, the ship was rock steady, not moving, the weather had improved. From that day onwards, I actually did not feel seasick. Seasickness is something which no one can cultivate. It's something to do with your body, and even normal persons can feel seasick, and a master, a captain who has been sailing for 20, 30 years, even he can feel seasick. But yet we get used to it. I would not say it's a difficult profession, but it's a very different profession. The biggest challenge is being away from the society, being away from your home, being away from the loved ones, which adds to the difficulties being faced out at sea. So at that time when I joined sea about 20 years back, the big container ships comprised of about 4,000, 5,000 containers. They were the biggest container ships, and they were considered to be very, very well technologically equipped. And then slowly as time passed, 5,000 became 8,000, 10,000. I worked on all these vessels, all these ships, 8,000, 10,000, 14,000, 20,000, and now it's going to be 24,000, 25,000. These ships are massive. They are just like a floating rock in the ocean. Being in charge of such an asset, it's a multi-million dollar asset, you see. The cost of the ship, the cargo, as well as the persons on board, they are priceless. I mean, the lives of those people cannot be compared in terms of money. So basically, it's just like a captain with his crew. These merchant vessels have about roughly 20 to 22 persons on the ship, which is now slowly decreasing. Initially, there were more persons, but with more and more automation, the manpower is slowly reducing. But yes, the crew trusts the captain, and with regards to the responsibility, it is actually huge responsibility on the shoulders of a captain. Sailing through the oceans, taking the cargo safely from one point to another, navigating the ship. At the same time, it's not only navigating. There are a lot of peculiarities of the cargo which is being carried in the containers. Containerization in the shipping was a very big invention, because precisely everything can be carried in containers, whether it is dry cargo, clothes, food, spices, or it is dangerous goods, chemicals, oils. Everything you think of can be carried in the container. So before the containerization, carrying anything which is irregular in shape, it used to be a very, very big challenge. But now they can be well segregated, like let's say two cargoes which cannot be carried together. They can be kept in separate boxes and can be carried on the same ship. So containerization is definitely a very, very major invention in the modern shipping, basically.
Now, just a reminder that you're listening to The Forum with me, Rajan Datar, and today we're talking about the impact of the humble shipping container on global trade with my guests, Mark Levinson and Alan McKinnon. Now, Alan, your own career in logistics spans over 40 years. So in your view, what do you think have been the main implications of the standardisation of the shipping container?
One of the constraints is the capacity of the ports to handle these enormous vessels, because the bigger they get, the fewer ports they can visit. So the main movements of the biggest containers these days are between what we call hub ports, the ones which have got sufficient handling capacity, sufficient depth of water as well. But what that means is that these bigger vessels are confined to a route with fewer ports. And it makes these big vessels then more dependent on what we call feeder ships, a second tier of container ships, which might have a 8,000 to 10,000 capacity load. And so this has been one of the major developments, say, over the past 20 years, when we really have seen this huge increase in the maximum size of new vessels.
And another consequence that I imagine has happened is that before, wouldn't you get like whole completed goods being delivered from one country to another? Now, different bits of the whole thing are made in different countries thanks to containerization. Is that right?
Yes. Well, certainly containerization has contributed to that process. If we look at how globalization has evolved over the past 20 or 30 years, one of the main features has been an increase in the complexity of global supply chains. What we've done is add more and more intervening links into those chains. Because what has been happening is that companies have been adding value to their products more incrementally in more locations. So as you said, you know, in the past, there was greater what we call vertical integration in manufacturing, where a lot more of the assembly processes would be confined to a single location. Now we have truly global supply chains or value chains, as people prefer to call them, because, as I say, value is now being added in more locations than previously. And I think most people, when they go to the shops and they pick an item off the shelf, they have just no appreciation of the complexity of the upstream supply chain that's delivered that product, particularly in the case of higher value manufactured goods like electronic equipment, for example. Now, the global container shipping system really has had to adapt to that change in the nature of globalization. And it's very doubtful that global supply chains would have become quite so complex as they are without the container.
We're going to talk a lot more about environmental effects of standardisation in the second part of the programme. But Mark, can you add to what Alan said? I mean, what for you have been the other implications of standardisation?
The container made shipping cheaper and more reliable. And this really enabled a new kind of trade. You can think of transport cost as a sort of trade barrier. Okay. When transport costs are high, a lot of things don't get traded. When transport costs are lower, then it suddenly makes sense to trade things. And what we saw with the container is that it took a while for businesses to figure out how to take advantage of the lower cost and the increased reliability of shipping. There were a couple of other innovations that were important. One was that international telecommunications costs collapsed in the 1980s. Suddenly it became much cheaper to make an international phone call. And of course, there was the development of desktop computing. And suddenly they could use their phone lines and their computers to keep track of production in places far away and use container shipping to move goods from one country to another. That's what really led to the creation of these international value chains. Most of the stuff that moves in containers is not something that you're going to go to the shop and purchase. Most of the stuff that moves in containers is what economists call intermediate goods, goods that have been processed in some way in one country and are being sent somewhere else for further processing or to be put into a component, to be combined with something else. And these intermediate goods then become part of other goods that eventually end up being a finished product that a consumer can buy. These long supply chains and this transport of intermediate goods is novel. There was not trade like this before the late 1980s. It was really a containerization and improved telecommunication that made it possible to have these long supply chains and all of this trade in intermediate goods.
I just want to end by asking you, both of you, very quickly, to confirm how we started this program. Do you believe that the shipping container kick-started globalization? Alan, let me ask you that first.
Well, it was an important factor. I wouldn't say it was the only factor that promoted globalization. It was also China's entry into the World Trade Organization. So it's partly a result of trade liberalization, you know, which is regulatory and relates to geopolitics. But from a logistical standpoint, there's no question that containerization provided the means for us to move freight more efficiently and more rapidly and more reliably around the world. So it was a contributor, but I wouldn't say it was the only thing which drove us to globalise the economy.
Sure. But Mark, would you say the world would be unrecognisable today if it wasn't for ship containers?
You can't imagine globalisation in the form it's taken without the shipping container. In the days before containers developed in the early to mid-1950s, a typical ship crossing the Atlantic Ocean between, say, New York and London, might carry 200,000 different items, and each of those had to be loaded individually onto the ship, and each of those had to be removed separately from the ship. Now, today's vessels are several times as large as the vessels of the early 1950s. So imagine that every time a vessel pulls into port, hundreds of thousands of separate items have to be removed and stowed away in a warehouse, and hundreds of thousands of other items have to be brought onto the wharf and loaded onto the ship. This just wouldn't happen. It wouldn't be possible. The shipping container made it possible to have this enormous growth in international trade. It definitely was not the only factor in globalization, but you really can't imagine modern globalization without it.
Well, there you go. That's the impact, really, of what we're talking about. Now, I do wonder how much stuff is actually floating around on ships at any one time. Enough to sustain a whole continent, perhaps? Well, today we're talking about how the shipping container has transformed global trade. And in this half, we're going to focus on current issues facing the industry. So, Alan, let's start with the environment. So what has the environmental effect of growth in container ships been?
You can look at that in two ways. You can look at the direct environmental impact of the vessels themselves, but you can also look at the environmental consequences of the huge growth in international trade which containerization has facilitated. And if we look at the second of these first of all, no question, containerization has made the global economy much more freight transport intensive. It's raised the level of production of a whole range of products in different parts of the world. And the production related emissions from that have been quite substantial, particularly as it shifted a lot of production away from the more developed countries to less developed countries where environmental regulations are more lax. But obviously, containerization has contributed to that, but it's not been the cause of that. You know, the shipping industry is implicated in these indirect environmental consequences. And I think if you're going to look at the environmental damage that's been done by this growth in international trade, I think you have to weigh that against all the economic benefits that it has brought, you know, in terms of expanding the global economy, promoting economic development, lifting people out of poverty. I think what we also have to consider is the fact that international trade can actually yield environmental benefits, you know, where the emissions from production in the exporting country are less than the emissions from production in the importing country, then it actually makes sense in environmental terms to source products, even if that means you source them over long distances and you move them there by container shipping. So therefore, as far as these indirect emissions are concerned, no question shipping's implicated, but I think a lot of those environmental effects can be justified on environmental terms. If we then move to look at the direct environmental impacts of shipping and how regulators have tried to contain that, the main thing to note, I think, about shipping operations, and that's not just container shipping, that's all forms of shipping, is it has been burning very dirty fuel. I mean, the perception for a time was that shipping was a relatively green transport mode, mainly because it's very energy efficient. But the trouble is the energy it uses is very dirty. So if you think of the oil refining process, first of all, you remove the light, clean fuels like kerosene and petrol, and then you go down to diesel. And right at the bottom, the last fraction that you extract from the oil refining process is what we call heavy fuel oil, which has been very rich in sulfur and other toxic chemicals. So that ships, in terms of their funnel emissions, their exhaust emissions, have been very dirty. And it's taken a long time, really, to reduce those emissions.
So what is being done about that? What are the different ways that we can reduce the CO2 impact of these huge ships?
Well, I think it's worth distinguishing the different types of pollution. So until recently, the main concern was sulfur emissions. Until recently, bunker fuel, the ship fuel, had about 27,000 parts per million of sulfur, by comparison with road vehicles, which would have 10 to 15 parts per million. So, you know, huge difference in the order of magnitude of the sulfur content in the fuel. NOx emissions, nitrogen oxide emissions, again, much greater from vessels. And particulate matter. There was a study done in 2007 suggesting there were about 60,000 premature deaths in port cities around the world because of people inhaling these very fine particles that come from fuel. So we distinguish the sort of pollutants that affect air quality from the greenhouse gases that cause the climate change problem. So, as I say, it's only comparatively recently that we've seen big improvements in the environmental performance of ships in terms of the other pollutants. But now we're beginning to see the shipping industry gearing up to do the same for greenhouse gas emissions, because shipping represents about 3% of global CO2 emissions. On current projections, on a business as usual basis, that could rise to 15% of global emissions by 2050, unless we do something about it.
So, in terms of the fuels, what can we switch to?
The fuel which is attracting a lot of attention these days as a lower carbon fuel is liquid nitrogen gas, or LNG. That can reduce your CO2 emissions by about 30%, right? So it's not a zero carbon fuel by any means. Some people are seeing LNG as being a transitional fuel that will save some CO2 emissions in the meantime. But in the longer term, we're going to have to switch to fuels which are very low carbon or zero carbon. And there are two contenders, really, for that fuel. One is what we call e-methanol, made by combining green hydrogen that we would make by, we would electrolyse water with low carbon or zero carbon electricity to give us green hydrogen. And we would then combine that green hydrogen with CO2. And hopefully a lot of that CO2 would be removed from the atmosphere using a process of carbon sequestration. So that would give us what they call an electrofuel, which would have a very low carbon footprint. The beauty of that fuel is it's a drop-in fuel. It could be used in existing vessels. It doesn't have to be held at low temperature or whatever. The other candidate is green ammonia, which again requires green hydrogen from electrolyzing water with low carbon electricity, but combining it with nitrogen. And that would have a high energy density. It could perform well. I mean, there are ships currently powered by ammonia in the world. But again, there's some downsides. One downside here is it has to be temperature controlled. It would have to be stored and moved at about minus 30 degrees. But whichever of these fuels ultimately dominates the move to low carbon shipping, we would have to produce in enormous quantities. And we would therefore have to create a whole new energy infrastructure to produce these fuels and also to distribute them to the ports. We'll have to do this if we want to have net zero shipping by 2050, but it's going to take time and it's going to require a huge investment.
What's wrong with good old-fashioned sails? Could they work at all?
They can certainly make a contribution. There are studies been done to suggest that by 2050, as many as 40% of ships could have sails on board. There are two things. One would be sails in the conventional sense, as we understand them. The other would be things called Flettner rotors, which are like cylinders you would put on the vessel, and they would use something called the Magnus effect to propel the vessel. We could never completely power the vessel with wind, but that could be a supplementary source of zero carbon energy. But certainly we shouldn't exclude wind from our consideration.
And Mark, you were just coming in. Come on.
It's likely that reducing emissions from shipping is going to make shipping slower and more expensive. This is something that a lot of people are starting to grapple with now. Already, it's very common that ships steam at slower speeds than they did a decade ago. And that's in order to conserve fuel. It reduces the cost of fuel and, by the way, reduces emissions in the process. The best way for ships to continue to reduce emissions is for them to steam more slowly. These alternative fuels, these fuels that are cleaner than today's bunker fuel, are likely to be pretty expensive. And so we will continue to see ships steaming more slowly. This means that it may take several additional weeks to get goods from Asia to Europe, or a couple of added weeks to get goods across the Pacific. This is a part of what's going to happen as shipping is cleaned up. And one of the things we're going to have to see is how much this is going to affect trade. Will slowing ships down even more cause manufacturers to move manufacturing closer to their markets rather than doing it halfway around the world? Will it raise the price such that some things are not traded anymore? We don't really know, but these are things that will come into play as there's more and more effort to decarbonize shipping.
Let's move on to supply chains, because there have been so much in the headlines recently. Mark, I mean, the shipping container is the smallest unit in vast and globally complex supply chains, but can you tell us why they faced such disruption recently?
During the pandemic, many supply chains were disrupted and freight rates rose enormously. We had governments and central banks around the world pumping a lot of money into their economies to avoid recession in the midst of the pandemic. And at the same time, we had, for health reasons, governments telling people they could not participate, they could not enjoy a lot of services. You couldn't travel, you couldn't go out to a restaurant, you couldn't go to the theater or the concert. So people had all of this money. They couldn't spend it on services for the most part. What were they going to do with it? They spent it on goods. And that's why all of a sudden we had these surging exports of exercise bicycles and sofas and things like that.
But because of the pandemic, I mean, were there huge pile-ups of goods at ports? And what was going on?
This surge in demand for goods really, I think, took the entire logistics industry by surprise. At the same time, the shipping industry, like every other industry, was dealing with the direct effects of the pandemic. You had ports being closed, for example, because there were workers who were getting COVID, and the authorities determined that the best way to stop it from spreading was simply to close the port for a week or two. You had factories that closed for the same reason. So this made the entire supply chain system much more confusing. And these things then built on themselves, okay? Just imagine you had a vessel that was supposed to leave Shanghai every Wednesday for Antwerp. Well, it couldn't leave on time because there were too many workers out because of COVID, okay? So now this ship was running 3 days late. At every port along the route, things are fouled up and it arrives in Antwerp at the wrong time and it can't get into the dock because other ships are there. So now it's got to wait a couple more days. And so now its return trip to Asia is going to be late. You can kind of envision how this cascaded. Ship lines ended up having to cancel many of their sailings just because their vessels were in the wrong place on the wrong day. So it was a very difficult situation. It's really returned to pretty much to normal.
Well, I was going to say, Alan, where are we now? Have we recovered completely?
Yes. But can I just add to Mark's answer there? One of the problems had that the rotation of containers was greatly slowed. To give an example, so in the Trans-Pacific route between the US and China, typically a container would cycle on that route every 70 days, right? Coming from a factory in China, going to a warehouse in the US, and then going back to China to pick up its next load. 70 days. That time went up to 100 days for the reasons that Mark mentioned, because of the delays right across the system. And as a result of that, we actually had a shortage of containers. There were so many empty containers which needed to be repositioned. So I think for the first time since containerization started back in the 1950s, the system lacked enough container capacity to meet the trade requirements. But this was a temporary phenomenon, as Mark said. We're now getting over this. We're not completely out of the woods as yet. I mean, it's only recently that China, for example, has abandoned its zero COVID policy, you know, so that production and port facilities in China until recently have still been quite seriously disrupted. But things are much better now. The situation is easing. And I would imagine probably sometime this year we'll get back to normal in terms of the sort of key parameters that we use to monitor the efficiency and reliability of container shipping.
Okay. Well, let's push into the future then. And Mark, how do you envisage the future of container shipping? What will it look like? Can we see a future where you've got crewless ships, which are battery powered, for example?
I don't think we're going to see autonomous ships except on very short routes. Right. You already have some tests of autonomous ships, but they're sailing a few kilometers and going into port. And I think the reason for that is pretty obvious. Suppose you had 12,000 truck-sized containers on a vessel in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. A big storm comes along. The ship has mechanical problems. Something needs to be done urgently because there's $1 billion worth of cargo on this ship. And there's no crew there? There's nobody to deal with that? That does not strike me as a very wise management approach.
Right. Now, Alan, tell me, what are your thoughts about the future?
Much will depend on the future development of international trade. And, you know, there are some very optimistic projections here. There are other people who think that globalization now will go into reverse, partly because companies will be prioritizing resilience, having suffered the pandemic and the Ukrainian war and the sanctions and so forth. They say that we're in really a very turbulent world and therefore it makes sense to source more product locally. I think that will happen to some extent, but nothing like as much as some people are now suggesting. But I think we really have to factor geopolitics into our future projections here, because regrettably, I think supply chains are now being weaponized. You know, governments realize that it can be a surrogate for military action. And then, of course, the response to that is sanctions, again, which impact supply chains. So I think that's going to be a major factor. But then looking at it from an environmental perspective, I mean, as an environmental researcher, I look at things through that particular lens. Ultimately, I think we may have a global system of carbon pricing. And that will impact on the patterns of international trade. But if you ask me where I think we're going, I think we'll probably be re-globalising the world economy, where more trade will be regional rather than truly global. the main growth may well be in these mid-range container ships. So maybe there'll be less reliance on China, but maybe more reliance on countries like Malaysia and the Philippines and Vietnam. And if these countries then build up their port capacity to deal with these bigger vessels, those mid-range vessels could help to serve this new pattern of more regionalized international trade than we currently see.
Well, thank you both very much indeed. There are some lot of fascinating facts there that I didn't know about, certainly beforehand. And I think it's pretty obvious that the shipping container has changed the world and will continue to do so. That's it for this edition of The Forum. Thanks to my guests, Alan McKinnon and Mark Levinson. And we'll be back next week.